In the matter of State versus Bullock, can we please have appearances of counsel?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Assistant Prosecutor Patrick Albieri appearing for the state.
Deputy Attorney General Frank Morosky appearing on behalf of the Attorney General as friend of the court.
On behalf of the Dominguez County Prosecutor's Association of New Jersey, John McNamara Jr.
Good morning, Your Honors. Rochelle Watson, Deputy Public Defender on behalf of Mr. Bullock.
Good morning, Your Honors. Janie Bialik from Cashman's Fine Walter Hayden here on behalf of Amicus, the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Christina Francois on behalf of the Imperia and representing the
Welcome, counsel. As I mentioned earlier, we're going to try to break at around 12:30. We'll get through Mr. Galdieri's argument and perhaps more, but maybe not. Mr. Galdieri, please proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. I would just ask to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
The appellate division in this case erroneously affirmed the suppression of defendant's three statements to law enforcement. Defendant's three statements to law enforcement were improperly suppressed because the state met its burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendants waived his Miranda rights validly after being advised of those rights by the detectives. I just want to address each of the three statements in turn. I'll start with the first of the three, which is the statement that occurred at Rutgers campus. And so that statement was improperly suppressed because the detective's questioning was part of an investigatory procedure, and it did not occur during a custodial interrogation, and that applies initially to what happened inside the dorm room where the defendant was found outside of the witnesses, Michael Clark's dorm room, and then ultimately when they went outside, the defendant, by the time that he was advised of his rights, he gave an implicit waiver of those rights, and prior to that point, he was not subject to custodial interrogation. The officers responded to the first there was the report that Michael Clark had a recording of the defendant threatening to harm his girlfriend's parents. And then there was a separate report that students in the lounge of the on campus overheard a threat being made, and they were afraid for their own safety. And Archibald's questioning of the defendant was part of the investigatory procedure that he was conducting and flushing out what exactly occurred and the nature of the reported threats and the recording that Michael Clark had. And prior to the point at which defendant was advised of his Miranda rights, he was not subject to custodial interrogation. And that's contrary to the finding of the motion judge in this case and then as affirmed by the appellate division. The defendant implicitly waived those rights by nodding his head up and down. As the judge did not make a finding on that actual head nod, but the appellate division acknowledged in a footnote that there was a slight head nod when Officer Archibald told him that asked him whether he understood those rights and that he could exercise them at any time. That's when the defendant slightly head nodded. And the state submits that goes towards the implicit waiver by the defendant of his Miranda rights that had just been repeated aloud to him. And the fact that he was told that he was not under arrest and was not in any trouble did not vitiate the propriety of that implicit waiver because he, at that point, in fact, was not in trouble or under arrest. And therefore, that statement was improperly suppressed both by the motion judge and then affirmed on appeal by the appellate division. As to the second two statements, those are both of the separate statements that the defendant gave at the police station that were recorded. The motion judge, the appellate division, and this court were all provided with the video recorded statements, both the initial statements on the initial statement on scene and the ones that happened at the police station. And as to the two at the police station, that's where Sims comes in. And this court issued an order asking the parties to brief the significance of this court's decision in Sims. And the state's position is that this court's decision in Sims makes clear that the appellate division erroneously affirmed the suppression of both statements at the police station because the appellate division relied on Sims as it was decided by another panel in the appellate division at that time prior to this court deciding Sims. And this court has since overruled and reversed Sims. So therefore, the basis for the appellate division's affirmance of the suppression of those two statements cannot stand. There was no complaint warrant or arrest warrant issued in this case, so there was no need to give a simple declaratory statement of any charges against the defendant simply because there were no charges against the defendant. The defendant was not under arrest. Officer Archibald testified to that. Initially, he testified that there were no charges. He hadn't lodged any charges against the defendant. He didn't have any intention to. When he was brought to the station, actually, if you listen on the, they have some discussion on the way to the police station. And in that discussion, the officer Archibald told the defendant on at least two occasions that he was not under arrest at that time. The detective Trado then testified that the defendant was not under arrest, nor was he charged while they were at the police station. And in fact, the complaint warrant was issued at 5 p.m. on October 30th, which was the same day and hours after the second police station interview ended, which would be the third of the three. This court's opinion in Sims makes it abundantly clear that because neither a complaint warrant nor an arrest warrant were issued against the defendant at the time of his statement to police, that the panel in this case incorrectly ruled that the detective's, quote, failure to inform defendant of the charges for which he was being placed under arrest was fatal to eliciting a valid waiver. Again, the defendant was not under arrest. There was no complaint warrant issued. There was no arrest warrant. It really is simple in that regard because Sims makes clear that there's no categorical requirement of advising a defendant what the nature of the charges against him is only triggered if there's a complaint warrant or an arrest warrant issued. Otherwise, it goes towards the totality of the circumstances. So for those reasons, the appellate division decision should be reversed, and the state submits that a remand to the appellate division to decide the issues relating to waiver that previously were not decided in light of its relying on Sims be then decided by the appellate division. If this court, however, were to exercise original jurisdiction and decide those issues, even though they weren't decided by the appellate division, the state relies on its arguments set forth before the appellate division, laid out in both its appellate division brief and then its supplemental brief to this court, that under this court's decisions in Tillery and AM, the defendant was appropriately Mirandized. He was read every one of his Miranda rights. He then acknowledged, and this goes towards both the statements that occurred at the police station. He read each Miranda right to himself. He initialed next to it. He responded yes or not or correct when he was asked if he understood each of those rights after he was read them by first Detective Trado and then Detective Rodriguez in the second statement. And then he read aloud the waiver portion of the Miranda card and then signed underneath it. And the critical distinction there between, as far as having him read the waiver right, he read it aloud. He didn't read it to himself. And therefore, he himself established his literacy and understanding of what he was reading in the waiver portion by reading it aloud and then signing. I think the prior precedent in AM and this court's decision in State versus Adams, which is a 1992 case, and then an appellate division case, State versus Masano, which is from 2005. They all talk about how there's a distinction between a defendant reading something silently to himself in the Miranda inquiry and not knowing his literacy or reading it aloud. So I think that's a critical distinction if this court were to reach the undecided issues from the appellate division in whether or not there were a valid waiver and shows that the state showed beyond a reasonable doubt that there was a valid waiver. With that,
at the point at which defendant was read his Miranda rights, read it himself, he had already made incriminating statements at the dorm prior to being Mirandized, correct?
I don't think the state, prior to when he was read his Miranda rights at the scene in the courtyard or lounge, as they yes. called it, he might have made incriminating statements, but I don't think they were subject to, or they were the result of a custodial interrogation. I think only after he was advised of his Miranda rights and then implicitly waived those rights is when he said, that certainly is the first time he said he made a threat about killing his girlfriend's parents. I know that's the first time he mentioned killing them. He was asked, why are we here by the officer? And he responded, I made a threat about harming someone. And he said, who? And then he said, my girlfriend's parents. So that was incriminating, but I don't think it was the subject of a custodial interrogation such that the Miranda warnings were necessary at that point. It was then after that he was advised of his Miranda rights.
Counsel, I'm sorry.
Was he free to leave at that point when he first made those comments?
According to the officer testified that he was not free to leave.
And what impact does that testimony have on the question of whether this was a custodial situation?
Well, it could be, it's a relevant consideration in that, like, it could be one of many factors that the court could consider in whether there were a custodial interrogation, but it's viewed from the standpoint of the arrestee or suspect at this point. So the fact that the officer said he was not free to leave does not then necessarily mean that a person in the defendant's shoes would objectively feel that he was not free to leave.
And then you have three officers in the courtyard surrounding him with his back against the wall. Was he free to leave at that point?
I think at that point, still, I mean, surrounding him, if you watch the video, as I presume the court did, there was one officer next to him. He had his hand on his belt. And then the officer Archibald, who was the initial responding officer, was standing about, I don't know, like 6 or 7 feet from him, 10 feet, whatever, questioning him. And the other officer was next to Officer Archibald. So I don't know if it was surrounding kind of suggests this, like, oh my God, I'm being surrounded. Where do I go now? I think they were standing there and talking to him. I don't think necessarily that means that he was not, that an objective person in his shoes would not feel free to leave.
With three officers standing in front of him, asking him questions.
He was detained at that point.
A reasonable person would feel they could just walk away.
He could be detained at that point, but that then doesn't necessarily mean that Miranda rights are triggered. It's just like during a roadside stop when a car is pulled over. That's a detention where the defendant's not free to leave when they're pulled over, but it doesn't mean that then they're Mirandized immediately when the cop comes over to the car window.
But the officers were asking him questions with regard to a criminal investigation at that point.
It was
with the purpose of eliciting admissions from him.
Yeah, they were asking him questions. They were, because I actually just watched that clip this morning, the initial interaction, and it was very rapidly unfolding. Actually, before they went to the courtyard, the defendant actually asked, and this is marked as indiscernible in the record and the transcript, but it can pretty clearly be heard, very clearly be heard, that he says, "Can we just go outside?" as they were going outside. So they went outside, presumably because the defendant didn't want to be in, you know, he was in a very tight hallway with just the cop. He wanted to go outside, so they went outside. And most of the questions related to the officers asking questions about his girlfriend's name and predicate information relating to her, such as her age/birthday.
What's the significance of the comment to him that he was not in trouble?
It's relevant towards the implicit waiver and certainly doesn't help the state, but it doesn't then mean that there was no implicit waiver.
What's your definition of trouble? You said earlier that was not a lie, that was not false when the assurance is made. Well, how do you understand the word trouble in this setting? You're not in trouble.
He was being investigated, but he wasn't in trouble. It wasn't like, we know you did something wrong, and it's just a question of what we're going to charge you with.
What if someone is suspected of doing wrong? Are they not in trouble? They can rest easy?
I mean,
it doesn't sound like Harry Hill from The Music Man, but, you know, it trouble's a pretty broad word, isn't it?
Well, it is, and that's why, the state interprets it as you're not in trouble yet, essentially.
But he had already made, and tell me if I have this wrong, he had already made admissions about wanting to harm his girlfriend and the parents.
He had. He hadn't said anything about killing them at that point. That was after he was advised of his Miranda rights, but he did say about harming his girlfriend and her
parents. After admitting that he wanted to commit harm against several individuals, was it false for the officer to say you're not in trouble?
I don't necessarily know if it was false. Perhaps
was it true?
The officer testified that he wasn't going to charge him at that point, and he didn't charge him. He wasn't planning on charging him. So if you interpret trouble as saying you're not legally in trouble, meaning you haven't legally been charged with a crime and we're not legally going to charge you with a crime necessarily, I don't think that's inconsistent. It might not have been, you know, it doesn't help the state's argument, of course, but I don't think it means that he then, you're not in trouble and you won't ever be, is kind of what the state's saying. That's not what the officer, that's not what that can reasonably interpret it as meaning.
How does the statement, "you're not in trouble," immediately preceding the defendant, the officer advising defendant of his rights, how does that not undermine the Miranda rights that the officer gave him to tell someone right after defendant has already made admissions, as we've established, the officer says, look, before anything goes anywhere else right now, you are not under arrest, you are not in trouble, I'm going to advise you of your Miranda rights. How does telling someone, you're not in trouble, but I'm going to advise you of your Miranda rights, how does that not undermine the rights the defendant has and in making that determination whether to waive his rights. An officer is just telling him, you're not in trouble, but I'm going to give you these rights anyway.
I mean, I don't think it goes towards the wisdom of the waiver, certainly, but not necessarily the validity of the waiver. The defendant's then told immediately after that, you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law.
But you're not in trouble. You're not in trouble, but I'm giving you these rights.
That's where the timing of it, I think, is important, because if he had given him the Miranda rights first and then said, you're not in trouble, you're not under arrest, but you understand these rights and you can exercise them at any time, then I think there would be a much bigger problem. The fact that he followed those statements up with the Miranda warnings shows that they don't vitiate the propriety of the waiver and the validity of the waiver that he ultimately gave.
Or it shows that the officer is treating the Miranda rights as a mere formality in saying, you're not under arrest, but I'm going to give you these rights.
Everything here was so rapidly evolving, and they're dealing with a threat about killing someone harming someone's parents or killing someone's parents. And
right. Which goes to the seriousness of what they were investigating.
Exactly.
And telling, but then also telling the defendant he's not in trouble.
Correct.
They're investigating a serious threat of this defendant possibly threatening to kill people, multiple people. But at the same time, this officer is telling this person, you're not in trouble.
Well, he wasn't in trouble at that point. I mean, the cop made clear that the officer Archibald said that he wasn't arrested, he wasn't being charged, and then he followed it up. You know, you can those statements are not saying you're not in trouble and then telling somebody, but anything you're about to say can be used against you and will be used against you are not inconsistent. That's the state's position, because he wasn't in trouble at that point. In fact, the officer clearly, when he said the state, he was giving the information about the girlfriend's parents, that was after he had said they said, why are we here? He said statements about harming somebody, and he said, harming who? And he said, my girlfriend's parents. They got information about the girlfriend. The officer, and I think he testified to this, kind of then realized, whoa, this is going down towards a path of getting incriminating statements during a custodial interrogation.
If the state or the attorney general were conducting a training academy session and instructing officers, would they caution against telling an individual who's already made admissions about serious criminality, you're not in trouble?
It would certainly be prudent to. I think this discussion that we're having here today kind of illustrates that would be the prudent course to take, that it would be better not to do that, because it doesn't help the waiver argument. The state submits it doesn't really hurt it, not much at least. But yes, I think that the better course would have been not to say that to the defendant. And I just want to add that regardless of what happened at the scene, what happened at the police station was an entirely separate encounter, an entirely separate interview, interrogation, that there's no O'Neill issue here. There's no taint from what happened at the scene. There was a fleeting comment made by Detective Trado during the first statement that said, we just have to do this again. But then they went through right by, like to a T, exactly what you're supposed to do. Read each right aloud, understood each right, both verbally and by initialing next to each right, and then read the waiver portion aloud to the detectives and signed underneath it.
Well, was the cat already out of the bag? Was defendant informed at that point that the statement that he had made prior to being Mirandized were not going to be used against him because they had not been, because he had not been Mirandized?
He was not told.
Looking towards the O'Neill factors.
He was not told that, of course. Again, just to reiterate, the state submits that there was no issue at the scene with Miranda, and that would not be necessary. That because O'Neill dealt with an entirely unwarranted statement that was in a clear custodial context. So that's a distinction that the state's arguing is present here. And even if it weren't a distinction, that's just one of the five factors under O'Neill. It's not dispositive that he wasn't told that what happened at the scene, those unwarranted statements can't be used against you prior.
So one of the factors is the extent that the post-warning questioning is a continuation of the pre-warning questioning. So as you mentioned, at the start of the second interrogation at the station, the officer says, you know, you already spoken to the officers, we need to do this again. Isn't that an indication that that was a continuation in defendant? From defendant's perspective, he has not been informed that his pre-warning statement cannot be used against him at that point. And here the officer's telling him, well, you already did this, we're just going to do it again.
I mean, that was...
And not being told.
I don't think that then means that therefore that factor weighs against the state. I think the fact that each right was then gone through by Detective Trado methodically, read aloud, and the defendant verbally acknowledged and then acknowledged by initialing each right after they were verbally after they were read, and then in total when he was given the card, and then verbally read aloud the waiver portion, I think that then completely negates any sort of prejudicial effect or connection or nexus between what happened at the scene and then what happened in the ensuing waiver by Detective Trado, and then later on at 7 a.m. by Detective Rodriguez. Also, the other factors, which are the degree to which the post-warning questioning is a continuation of that's the one we just discussed, whether the same law enforcement officers conducted both the unwarned and warned interrogation, that unequivocally weighs in the state's favor because it was Detective Trado and Detective Rodriguez that were there. Officer Archibald wasn't even there at that point. The proximity and time and place between the pre- and post-warning statement, that weighs in the state's favor, too, because, I mean, this was about 4 hours later. It was at the police station. It wasn't on the scene. The defendant was told that he wasn't under arrest when he was taken there. He then waited, and the testimony was that although there was no video of what occurred in the room he was waiting in, he was in a domestic violence victim, a room typically reserved for domestic violence victims, waiting with another cop. They had the body-worn camera footage, which wasn't presented, nor does the state admit it was necessary or anything, of the cop that was with him while he waited to be interviewed by Detective Trado. These were clearly separate interviews that were being conducted, such that what happened at the station is sufficiently not affected by any sort of taint that, again, the state submits didn't occur, but even if it did, that was rectified by clearly giving the Miranda rights as laid out on the card and as the defendant read aloud in the waiver portion.
You touched on an implied waiver earlier in your comments. What's the standard to determine whether an implied waiver exists?
It's a totality of the circumstances analysis that looks to, it's similar to whether or not the waiver that was given, the O'Neill factors, not the O'Neill factors, the implied waiver and whether or not a waiver was validly given, those factors kind of overlap. It's the age and experience, prior contact with the criminal justice system, age and intelligence of the defendant.
Do we look for a clear manifestation?
Yes, that's made clear in Tillery.
And the slight nod of the head satisfies that?
I think so. It was slight, but I mean, I think most people, when they agree they understand something, you know, don't really vigorously nod their head. I think the head nod is clear, and it's clear that it's in response to the detective saying, or the officer Archibald saying, you understand those rights and that you can exercise them at any time. He clearly nodded his head and responded to that. And the state pointed out in its supplemental brief that this court's recent opinion in Ahmad says that when factual findings are not made by the trial court to the extent that they influence the ultimate legal determination, that lack of a factual finding and the testimony that comprises that factual finding can actually be reviewed de novo. And I think it was error for the motion judge not to address the head nod in rejecting the state's argument that there was no implied waiver.
So I'm sorry, you were asking for a remand to the appellate division? Are you suggesting that the record then was fully developed? You just talked about what the trial judge failed to do. Are you seeking a remand to the appellate division or to the trial court?
I was talking about the trial judge, the motion judge failing to address the head nod. Mm-hmm. I don't think a remand to the motion judge just for that, you know. The state's asking for a remand to the appellate division to address the issue of the waiver as it relates to the Tillery argument, which is laid out in the appellate division briefs and
It was the Sims issue.
The Sims issue is the basis for the appellate division's opinion. That was not addressed in briefs. There was a 2611D letter submitted by the public defender calling the court's attention to Sims in the appellate division when it was decided, which has since been overruled. And there was one fleeting mention of it at oral argument. It was over Zoom during COVID. There was a question about Sims, but there was no, I mean, this was a fairly long oral argument in the appellate division. There were a lot of other questions relating to waiver and the arguments that related to Tillery. There was really no discussion of Sims.
Tillery was not new at that time.
Tillery was not, no. And that was really discussed at length in the judge's written amplification of his opinion. It focused on Tillery. Really, until this appellate division opinion came out saying, our opinion in Sims shows that the defendant needed to be told what he was under arrest for. Yeah, there was no actual arrest, but there was a de facto arrest. He needed to be told what he was under arrest for, and that's why we're affirming the suppression of those statements.
But the reason you want a remand is about Sims.
The reason, the state's asking this court to reverse based on its decision in Sims. and say that the appellate division was wrong. Sims is a categorical rule that says that you're allowed, Sims makes clear the rules from AGD and Vincente and Nyhammer that if you are charged in a complaint warrant or issued an arrest warrant is issued, that you need to be told in a simple declaratory statement what you're being charged with. That did not occur here, and it wasn't argued that there was a totality of a there was no totality of the circumstances analysis as it related to the lack of being told that he was under arrest.
So you're,
but isn't that only, sorry, doesn't that only apply to the statements at the police station?
Yes, the Sims issue.
Correct. So then what's the basis for the remand for the consideration of the statements in the hallway at Rutgers and in the courtyard
that
at
can
Rutgers,
be decided
both
that,
pre and post the Miranda warnings?
Up until, it's actually a great question. The initial statement can be ruled on and should be ruled on by this court, the statement that happened at the courtyard and the implicit waiver issue. That doesn't relate to the Sims argument. The remand would just be for the second two statements, both of which occurred at the police station, because that's when Sims was implicated either way.
Can you clarify something else?
Mm-hmm.
Do you or does the defendant contest the APTIV's determination that the consent search, the question of the consent search, should go back to the trial court? You contest that?
If this court determines that Sims was in an appropriate, the appellate division's decision in Sims was in an appropriate basis for its affirmance of the suppressed statements, then there would be no fruit of the poisonous tree analysis to remand to the trial court. So then that would be necessarily erroneous, that part of the appellate division's opinion. The state agrees with the reversal, of course, of the suppression of the physical evidence, but then a remand to the trial court for the fruit of the poisonous tree part, as the appellate division ruled, wouldn't be necessary or in existence, because there would be no fruit of the poisonous tree. The state would win on the admission of the statements that occurred at the police station. And therefore, the consents were fine, and there's no fruit of the poisonous tree to analyze whether or not they flowed from. Does that answer Your Honor's question?
I'm trying to discern if that issue is before the court.
Well, on that note, there is no cross appeal from the suppression of the physical evidence by the defendant. So really, that issue, whether or not consent was validly given, should not be addressed by this court.
Sorry, you mean there's no cross appeal on the non-suppression?
On the non-suppression, on the reversal, or the reversal of the suppression of the physical evidence. Yes, I misspoke.
That's the defendant's issue only.
That's the defendant's issue.
But as to your request for a remand, I'm sorry to keep coming back.
No,
to this.
No.
If the appellate division improperly relied on Sims to uphold the order, the trial judge also relied on Sims. So if you're asking for a remand, why not remand first to the trial judge, and then the appellate division can review a new record?
Well, the trial judge, if I'm not mistaken, didn't rely on Sims. By the appellate division came out after the briefing in the appellate division on this case, hence the public defender's 2611D letter calling the court's attention, the appellate division's attention to Sims as decided in the appellate division. The trial judge really relied on this distinction between a defendant being read the waiver portion of the Miranda card and reading it to himself, whether aloud or silently. And Sims really didn't come up until it was brought up in the 2611D letter, briefly at oral argument, one question, and then was the basis for the appellate division's opinion. So the remand wouldn't be, this court's reversal and overruling of Sims makes clear that the appellate division's decision as it relates to the two statements at the police station cannot stand. And then the appellate division should address the waiver issue relating to the Tillery arguments and the reading of the Miranda card as it was argued before it.
Which it never reached.
It never reached those because it decided on Sims. I mean, that's when it says, and I pointed out in the state supplemental brief, they acknowledge that this is a situation that's different from Tillery, but they say something, the appellate division that is, says something like, we need not address the Tillery, the issue relating to the waiver under Tillery, because the defendant wasn't told what he was under arrest for under Sims.
Which would knock out all of the three?
The Sims,
as far as the appellate division was concerned, it knocked out, it required suppression of all three statements?
The Sims issue, the appellate division applied, although Sims was incorrectly decided, as this court ruled, it applied Sims to the two statements at the police station. The original statement was, although incorrectly affirmed, the state submits, by the appellate division, was properly decided based on implicit waiver And
Not on the basis of Sims.
Correct. Sims was only triggered, whether it was the appellate division's incorrect ruling or this court's overruled ruling, Sims was only triggered, that issue was only triggered at the police station prior to the first of the two statements at the police station.
Do you agree with the Attorney General that this court should state that the appellate division should not rely on decisions that have been stayed by this court pending review?
The state does agree with that. That actually was a big part of the state's motion for leave to appeal and why this court should take this case. This was prior to Sims being decided. I think it was, and actually there's a published appellate division opinion, I think Judge Susswine wrote, that talks about this court having stayed that opinion and what exactly the stay meant and whether or not it was a stay of that actual case as it proceeded through the trial court prior to the appellate division opinion, or whether it was a stay of it being precedential moving forward. And although another panel's decision is not binding on, a panel's not bound by another panel's published decision, it can be published authority, persuasive authority. I think it was inappropriate to rely on an opinion that was clearly stayed by this court even as persuasive authority, because it would be no different essentially than relying on an unpublished opinion. I mean, at that point, the opinion in Sims, the appellate division's opinion had been stayed. The state treats that stay based on the way the prosecutor's office moved for the stay and the court granting the motion for a stay, applicable not only to the proceedings that then ensued in that case, but also to how it would be relied on as published authority and to what extent moving forward by other panels.
What if the second panel doesn't rely explicitly on a case that's been stayed, but offers reasoning that is quite similar because it believes that to be the appropriate statement of the law? Should we be in the business of telling them? Is that a distinction that makes any sense?
It's a fair question, of course. But I see what Your Honor's saying, basically, that if you know, they could have reached the decision they reached in this case without even mentioning Sims and essentially just mirroring the analysis in Sims. I suppose that would then be okay. But to say, I mean, they made clear that, like, we decided Sims, we're persuaded by this published authority, and therefore we're applying it. So I think that distinction isn't really applicable here, where they clearly relied on what they didn't even mention the stay, actually, in this case, in the appellate division, in the opinion. And I think that's key, that they thought this was binding on trial courts, but published good law that was not stayed. Otherwise, I think it's pretty clear, based on it being the dispositive reliance by the appellate division, that they would have mentioned, at least in a footnote, that the Sims opinion was stayed.
And the lawyers brought that to the panel's attention.
Don't know if it was stayed at the time. I know I didn't bring it to the panel's attention.
Would it be different if it was a request to stay an unpublished decision, which is not precedential, and then having the scenario the Chief Justice suggested where the reasoning is similar?
I still
the staying of an unpublished opinion, does that affect the reasoning of appellate panels while the Supreme Court is reviewing that unpublished opinion?
Well, the unpublished opinion would technically not even be, shouldn't even be cited regardless of whether or not it was stayed. So in that sense, I don't think
it can
be
cited to the court, not by the court, under Rule 136, right?
Yeah. So as far as the court's reliance on it, then it wouldn't be cited regardless of whether or not a stay had been issued. So I think in that sense, there wouldn't really be a distinction.
Other questions, anyone?
No.
Is there anything you'd like to add?
To the extent I didn't address anything expressly here, I just reiterate the arguments set forth in the state supplemental brief. Thank you,
Mr. Galdi.